The addiction is the rehearsing subconsciously of some prior emotional event that keeps us in this repetition of bonding, or even if the emotional pain has been worked with a bit, there's a habit of mind also that we have to contend with. And so there's so much going on there. But if you can get beyond that, if you can get beyond the story and have it like blessed in a certain way, you know, by being held with somebody in an unconditional space. And all of this came from Ram Dass.
Jamie, love is the author, and my good Ojai friend in arms.
How's it going, buddy?
Okay, nobody. I'm nobody.
That's right, or pal. No pal either, right?
No pal. But better nobody. I'm becoming nobody.
Yes, perfect. Great to see you.
Yeah, great to see you too. And everybody, Jamie's been on the podcast before, I don't know, a year ago maybe?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yep, it was a year ago.
And I really appreciate it, some of the work that Jamie does aside from what he does on podcasts, Love is the Author, but helping people out, especially through your experience with addiction counseling. And let's talk about that for a minute. You know, maybe just describe Jamie, if you had heard the podcast that we did together a year, whatever it was ago, he has gone through, you know, severe trauma in his life related to addiction. And so on. So it's in that sense, of course, you're kind of being groomed to be able to help people, right?
Yeah, no, completely. It's like understanding the mud. You know, today, like my father, not too long ago, came over to visit at a time where we were having it was a gathering that you were there at, where both of my Tibetan teachers were here and doing blessings and at our house. And my father was here and he was like surveying the scene and which is kind of like, I'm trying to recreate what you guys were doing, you know, back in the 70s, you know, I'm really trying to kind of, and without trying, but it's just kind of naturally what my bent is that time, that summer of love through the 70s, you know, where there was people were awakening up. And even though we didn't have ultimately a way to sustain all that awakening just at the start, it's a time that I romanticize. And so the house is kind of at that at that gathering, you know, it's looking like that, like a happening kind of, you know. And my dad's looking around and he goes, you know, this is a really beautiful life that you've made for yourself, you know. And it was very sweet, incredibly sweet. And it's something, I don't know, I feel in a lot of ways that like It was a statement that maybe I was looking for my whole life in some way, you know. But in this moment, it felt very ordinary. And I just said to him, you know, everywhere I look, Dad, you see beauty. I see the mud, you know. I just see the mud. This all came from the mud. Like, I can't see it any other way. I burned my life to the ground. And yes, trauma was a part of it. And then I traumatized myself by thinking that a new identity might help. And the identity is really, for me, what has hurt the most, because the identity that we take on, you know, it has its own jurisdiction, its own ethics, its own, you know, its own way. And all my former identities have really brought me into a lot of pain association, a lot that I was creating myself after, I guess it would be considered like the second arrow or something in Buddhism. They talk about, you know, the first one is the pain itself, but the second arrow is the one that we add, you know, to the situation.
Piling on. Yeah.
Totally. And so, yeah, I mean, I with the addiction thing, it has made me suitable to be able to help people at their darkest. I mean, sexual abuse also, going through that when I was younger, has been a doorway to be able to help people in that same position over and over and over again, because it really is, for that particular situation, you know, the passport that's needed in that moment is actually having been there. And for people who have been there, who have some skillful means and being able to be present with somebody, it can be life-changing. And so all of my drudgery and all of the things that formerly hurt are now doorways to connect with people. And my Tibetan Buddhist study and practice and immersion, you know, I'm a sucker for the Dharma, you know, because it's done me so well.
I like that. Good book title, Sucker for the Dharma.
Yeah. Original you and I moment right now. I mean, it's there. People are waking up right now, and people are as they have been. But I mean, there's a lot of great information, a lot of ways to cultivate emotional intelligence. And there's so much information. And my delivery system for it hasn't been an in your face model. And I think with all the great information that is out there, that's available, a lot of people in my position of being either a spiritual teacher or healer or whatever it is, a recovery counselor at various times, you go on Instagram and it's someone yelling at you, like their thoughts about like something random that it's random to you in that moment. Or it may even be a synchronistic, wow, whoa, this person's great. But it's yelling. And in no monastery or sacred place that I've ever been does it start with somebody greeting you at the door, yelling at you about some wonderful dharmic thing, you know? And so
I like that idea, though. It could be a good sitcom, you know, opens up in a Western ashramic kind of situation with people in white clothes. And then the door opens and you get a kind of Larry David type screaming at you because of
so funny.
Oh God.
So funny, because you are kind of, to me, hanging out with you as much as I get to, it is a Larry David situation. Like, it's spiritual Curb Your Enthusiasm. I get to watch you get annoyed by shit that is so funny to me, because it's like, look, somebody has to work with the Dharma and their unfoldment and all these different things from a business standpoint. It's just hilarious to watch you at times.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean,
you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And the reality is, and this is the key to anybody's success in getting some balance in their life moving forward, is having a sense of humor.
Oh,
as Ram Dass so often said, and was quite that himself.
Yeah.
And that sense of humor will get you out of a lot of self-seriousness trouble.
Oh, so, totally.
Yeah. I mean, we all have personalities. So, yeah, I have this one, you know, that's as quirky as anybody.
Your karma. I mean, honestly, your karma is such a particular karma, because it's kind of put you in, at least, and this is my fun projection vantage point situation with Raghu, is that I watch you and it's kind of like, you're kind of like the mafia boss of the operation.
Jesus Christ.
No, and I don't mean in the way of violence, but I mean in the way of like there's a line in Goodfellas where one of the mafia bosses is being described, and they're like, you know, when it came to Paulie, he's like, he didn't say much because he didn't have to say anything. And he didn't do anything because he didn't have to do anything for anybody. And you are very selective with what you get energetically engaged with, I would say. And you have to, I imagine, because I think about your karma being the one who has to steward, all of the great teachings from Ram Dass and all that, in a way of being able to keep the lights on, so to speak, and make sure that people are taken care of and more publishing can happen. Like, you being in that position is not a desirable position for me, like, thinking about, you know. So I always have compassion for you being that one who has to merge these worlds.
I always say, you know, this is being a director of Ram Dass's work through this foundation, good work if you can get it, right? But yeah. You just described, I have the right sweatshirt on.
Oh, yeah, Badmash. That's right. That's right. I love that sweatshirt.
Maharaji used to call us Badmash all the time. Rascal. You know?
Totally.
So somebody made this and gave me one. So I guess it's appropriate.
Yeah. Well, even watching you at the retreat, you know, watching you, are you enjoying it? That's what I wanted to ask you. I'm not saying, are you satisfied at a deep gratification level of that you're able to play your part and that people are enjoying themselves, but at the retreats, when Krishnadas is singing and when you're having to move through the audience and you're monitoring, you know, the recordings of it and all, like how much of you gets to actually be there and enjoy it?
I actually have a good example of that. Yes, you and I actually went to see Krishnadas do his thing, Kirtan, at last a concert night. At a big venue in L.A. Amazing mm-hmm. how many people, eh? 1,200 people in there.
Yes.
So on my way in, I don't know what happened to you. You could have come with us if I had known. But on my way in, terrible traffic on that.
Oh, yeah.
F-ing 101.
Yeah. <help. laughs>
Two and a half hours.
Oh, wow.
It was miserable. Yeah. So the more I went along, the kind of grouchier I got to the point I was going, Krishnadas, I've been doing this with him and, you know, for longer than I care to recall. What did I really think I needed to come here so I could come in and say hi?
Right.
Anyhow, that's how mind was going, and you know, I let it go, and then sat down.
Yeah,
and I was at the. I went earlier, which is why I got into that traffic. I wanted to hang out and during the sound check, you know. So
yeah,
I was sitting there and talking with friends, and then suddenly he began his process of sound checking, and he, because of who he is not doing it as a toss off. In other words, this is just for the sound check.
Right. You know,
he's doing it because it's mantra, you know. So I'm sitting there and then suddenly he starts doing the Hanuman Chalisa, everybody. It's 40 verses in praise of the monkey god Hanuman, who we were told as soon as we got to India was synonymous with Christ.
Wow.
Complete, absolute, only interest was how they could serve and their total immersion in love of the divine.
Wow.
So that's what one of the biggest things that was brought back, you know, through our tradition and primarily by Krishnadas. And so anyhow, he starts doing it, you know. By that time, I calmed down about the 2.5 hours in traffic thing.
Yeah,
and
good.
And then, boom. I just completely went out and I just was so absorbed into the moment with the presence of my guru, of what that really is beyond, you know, just in that moment. And, I saw him after that, which in between the sound check and the actual kirtan. And I told him, I said, you know, I came in here and I get this horrific traffic thing and 2.5 hours. And but I was wondering what the fuck I've been doing, you know, since you and I have been doing this for so long and I've been listening for you, to you. We used it started out in the 70s after Neem Karoli Baba died. We were all living in New York and we had a friend who had a loft. His name was actually Loft. So it was kind of perfect, his last name. He and I would go in there. I played, the two-sided Indian drum called a nal or kol or mridangam, depending which type you had. And he would sing, and then he would play a little, I would sing. So we, this started at that time, you know. And he had been an aspiring musician. Blue Oyster Cult wanted him, you know, to be the lead singer, that whole story. So he was into it, and he's the one who really picked up the chalisa with another friend, Ramesh, in India, and translated, you know, got it translated and the whole thing and brought it back. So so the way in which that particular thing cuts through, no matter what crazy bullshit is in your head, be it the ridiculousness of getting caught in traffic or something, you know, a lot more difficult to deal with, to say the very least, the Hanuman Chalisa for us has been that doorway to for transformation of the moment, you know, absolutely. Yeah. So that happened to me in that moment. And that happens to me. And as far as the retreats that we were at, honestly, making sure everybody's happy is my goal here. I'm not thinking about whatever I could or couldn't get out of anything. Although I may sit there and Jack Kornfield may say something, as he usually does, you know, just codifies something beautifully and, you know, it rings a bell. But mostly, mostly it's through the kirtan that I can really let go.
Man, you just reminded me of... Oh, and that's so beautiful. And last night it was palpable, as it has been at the times that I've seen Krishnadas now. My son, I brought him there, Tiger, for the first time, and my daughter Sia, and Tiger.
Wait, last night?
Yeah, they were with me.
Oh, I didn't see them. Huh.
Yeah, they were sitting right with me. I mean, maybe they didn't. Were still in that. Yeah, exactly. Maybe you're still dealing with traffic in your mind.
Yeah, right.
You know, Tiger was feeling it. He was in the aisles, and he was trying to pull me into the aisles. And you know, there's a weird high that I hate to call it that because I know that's not the game. You know, is to get high, but there is a weird high being at the retreat that I didn't count on. I didn't expect that I would change a state or something. I'm in a pretty good state. I'm happy with my state most times. And there is a weird elevated thing at the retreats that's so immersed that actually coming off of it, oddly enough, I have to say there was weird, like a come down coming back to the states. There's a weird, and it wasn't like, oh, I miss the people. I don't miss anything in my life. Everything's I really pay attention when I'm there, but it was a bodily thing, very strange. And I was like, wow, okay. So there's an elevated state that we can all be in that actually stepping out of, you might feel the kind of kick from the cold turkeyness.
Yeah. How about when I get a call from Ram Dass saying Neem Karoli Baba died? In the middle of where I was after I had come back, we came back together from India, just planning to get a new he had a new visa, whatever the hell it was. It wasn't like I mean, less him, he was less attached to that body.
Wow.
You know, less, more, I don't know. But yeah, we went, imagine the cold turkey we went in. But you know how, but we dealt with it by being a spiritual bypass. It was very convenient at the time. Being like this, he's completely one with everything. He doesn't need a body, which, you know, that's true too.
Right.
But we were using this to avoid the pain. So,
spiritual bypass. I mean, sure. And did the pain, was it like in the installment program where it was kind of like over a number of years or something that you deal with that pain? Or was there a moment where you feel like, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was years. But it's the fooling of oneself that is really disturbing, you know?
Yeah.
And you realize just what you're doing. I had some idea that, I would like to just sort of reference, which has always been dear to me, and it's around darkness. Mm-hmm. I don't mean the dark, emotional darkness. I mean absolute darkness out of which the light can come.
Oh, right? Wow.
That kind of. Yep. So there's a somebody you might consider actually for your podcast. Her name is Deborah Eden Tull, T-U-L-L. And she wrote this great book. Some time ago, we did a podcast. It's Luminous Darkness. Really great.
So beautiful title.
She
is
quoted,
she a cousin of Jethro?
Yeah. No.
That's a guy, right? Jethro Tull?
Yeah. I don't think that. No, that's a band.
No, I know.
Anyhow, this is from Rainer Maria Rilke. So this is Rilke and his poem called The Night. I don't know. I'll read it. You darkness of whom I am born, I love you more than the flame that limits the world to the circle it illuminates and excludes all the rest. But the dark embraces everything, shapes and shadows, creatures and me, people, nations, just as they are. It lets me imagine a great presence stirring beside me. I believe in the night. How great.
Yeah.
Real
good. I laughed earlier when you brought up the darkness. I had a chuckle to myself because I'm headed back into a sweat lodge, and it's been about 7 years. And the darkness, that's where I learned about what you're talking about, the luminous darkness. Was both of those words actually came out of my experience in Sweat Lodge ceremony, which, you know, is an ancient ceremony to recreate the beginning of everything. You know, it takes you back to the darkness, and you get dark in this sweat, and it's from there that there was potential, and all of this came. And so I'm headed back into that. And when I was in there, I worked at this addiction and mental health center in Malibu called Oro House. I was a spiritual director there of their earliest years, and it's become a really big facility now. And when I was there, I developed this sweat lodge program. And so every week I would take a van full of detoxing or people stabilizing from their mental health. I would drive this van. And this is very kind of old school, like Ram Dass, all like you guys' whole world. This feels like The Rascal. This feels like Badmash a little bit. You know, I came into the addiction to mental health world after finding something beyond me. And this center wanted me to share that with people, this sort of being beyond identity, you know, and how can you cultivate that in life? And they figured that that was something important when dealing with addiction, because the addiction is the rehearsing subconsciously of some prior emotional event that keeps us in this repetition of bonding, or even if the emotional pain has been worked with a bit, there's a habit of mind also that we have to contend with. And so there's so much going on there. But if you can get beyond that, if you can get beyond the story and have it like blessed in a certain way, you know, by being held with somebody in an unconditional space. And all of this came from Ram Dass. All of it came from listening to lectures, reading Be Here Now, very early introductory thing. I was listening to lectures every week on YouTube in 2013, and now in this job in 2014, teaching people how to do this and taking them to sweat lodges. It was all really based in what Ram Dass had shown. I had been a practicing Tibetan Buddhist for sure, but now there was a person who actually was embracing both the Buddhist and the sort of the Hindu experience.
Bhakti. Bhakti.
I wanted to say bhakti, but Hindu, like, are you saying the wrong word?
Yeah, no, yeah. There's so much. I mean, the myriad of paths within Hinduism is extraordinary, including what Tibetan Buddhism came out of was, you know, Nalanda, you know, that university.
Yes, right. That's right. Yeah. I'm reading the Bodhisattva, the Way of the Bodhisattva right now for the second time. Mm-hmm. I thought about you a bunch this morning when I was reading that. But anyway, like this going beyond self thing, every week I would, as this facilitator at this treatment center, take people to the sweat lodge, and it was far up in the mountains. It was about an hour away from any hospital or anything like that. And there's not even good cell reception there at this place. But every week for 3 years, I brought these van loads of people into the sweat lodge with a skillful leader, not myself. I was just helping, but a sweat leader there who is a teacher of mine, Miguel Rivera. And we did this every week for 3 years, and without incident, without a boo-boo, without anything going wrong ever. All these people in varying states, coming off of drugs, varying traumas, varying mental health situations, various financial backgrounds, and all kinds of stuff. Every week we'd go into the dark and people would get it. Mm. And it was like they were in touch with something beyond them. You can't go anywhere in the lodge, you know, really. You're signed up for it when you're in there, you know, and it's getting hot. And you're like, can I really take this? Yeah. And you learn something about the dark, you know. It's very beautiful. You come out of the darkness after the sweat is over, and the ground has been swept outside. And so you step and you start making fresh tracks as maybe a person who's more familiar with the luminosity of the darkness.
Mm, yeah, that's good stuff. Really.
What do you think about the darkness?
I don't know. I completely always loved being in a cave-like dark atmosphere since I was a kid. So I think there's some kind of, for me, practice memory of maybe of being in dark spaces, practicing some way. So it's been a comfortable place for me, which is a weird thing. I have more problem with light. Like in the morning, light, no. Anyhow, it's some neurotic BS. So, but
what do you think about the charnel ground?
Wonderful place. Wonderful place to hang out. I was in, when I first was in India, I had been with Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba for a while. And we went to, just some friends, Benares, where they've been burning bodies, the charnel ground, for thousands of years, right? And we went to the oldest one called Manakarnika in Benares, in Kashi. And we did what's called bung lassi, which is, you know, they take cannabis and they grind it and mix it with almond drink and this. It's really phenomenal. Of course, you can get bad case of parasites while you do that. But we took some of that, and it's a bit like, I mean, it's very powerful. I can't say acid, but in that neighborhood, much more than today eating a gummy, let me say.
Oh, yeah.
Unless, I guess you ate a bunch of them. Anyhow, we went and sat in the charnel grounds.
Wow.
Just completely being, the first time in our lives, and we're talking about, you know, 23, 4 years old we were. And just absorbing the process of these bodies being burned, turned into ashes, with depending on how much wood you have, because if you're if you're someone, unfortunately, that hasn't got money and you've come to Benares to die, your body wouldn't be completely burned, and then you have animals eating it on the way out to the river. I mean, it's really awful that way.
So there's body parts left over from the burns because there wasn't enough wood to cremate.
Yep. And the dolphins eat it.
The dolphins.
There's Holy dolphins shit. In that part of the Ganges River.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Wow.
Son of, one of the furthest out places you can ever go to. Yeah. Anyhow,
because I think this shirt has blood on. I'm into
what
embracing that aspect of it too. I think it has blood on it. I bought it yesterday at this vintage.
selling bloody shirts. Oh my god! There is something. What if somebody was shot there? Are you crazy?
I think somebody might have been shot. This is from the 1930s, and it's just it reminds me, like I'm reading, as I told you, The Way of the Bodhisattva, and in there's sort of this talk about like even putting on perfume. It's sort of like, what are you doing? You're dressing up a corpse that is eventually going to smell terrible. Yeah. You know, and you're making it smell like some other part of nature. Mm. Like, what is it? Why are we doing that? You know? And so this kind of stuff, it reminds me of impermanence, wearing vintage clothing, but vintage clothing with blood on it. That's even better because it's sort of like really a reminder of how short of time we might have.
Can I tell you that I can't even go into a vintage store, a secondhand store, whatever. I can't.
Because of dust?
No.
What?
Try again. What? Possibly beyond the material.
Oh, really? Mm. Like spiritual energy of the former owners?
Correct, Amundo. I can feel it. And it's like, sometimes like overwhelming. I went with my partner, Katrina, and she said, okay, we're going. I want to look in the back. I said, okay, goodbye. I'll wait for you outside because the intensity of this vibration is more than I want to deal with it right now.
That happens to me at Ross Dress for Less.
Oh yeah.
Only I'm like, what are we doing? We're buying the garbage that people didn't want at the other stores. And this is going to be your garbage soon. And it's just going back into the earth. And so I used to feel that in those places a bunch,
Well, that's so back to the charnel grounds. That is, part of the charnel grounds, and what would be maybe profitable for me is if I find a chair, sit in that store and close my eyes and see about transforming, which is what happens at the charnel grounds. What I did with the Bung Lhasi, and my friend and I literally sat there for 10 hours straight. We didn't move, just watching this procession of bodies turn to ash. And they crack the skull at one point and to get the fluid out. And you end up seeing, sometimes if there isn't quite enough wood, you see just the feet left, the skeleton. It's like, so it is absolutely a very valid practice, being in the charnel.
Man.
So let me.
People don't see that when they see your American Express, you know? When you're using the American Express, or when you're doing business or something, like part of what's gone into you doing business is being there in that charnel ground. You know, is the charnel ground still alive in you, that moment? It sounds like it is, and has influenced some aspects of your life.
I will never forget that moment. Absolutely not. And, you know, and now that I'm way older and getting near to the transition, near whatever that means, you know, that is very much part of my ecology related to being okay in the dark, in the bardos eventually.
Yeah.
So she says, we use the phrases dark matter and dark energy to refer to more than 95% of the energy density in the universe, which has never been directly detected in the laboratory. That's crazy. Roughly 95% of the universe remains a complete mystery to science. In other words, scientific research has found that only 4.6% of life as we know it, including the Earth, planets, and stars, is made up of atomic matter. Because we have no idea what the roughly remaining 95% is, we refer to it as dark. While our negative associations with darkness might seem innocent, I believe there are profound implications in our historical and collective rejection of darkness. The continual reference to darkness as negative and sinister, and the assumed divide between light and dark, has created a severe tear in the fabric of human relationship. It has caused a dualistic fracture in how we see everything.
That's
good,
right.
Bad, right, wrong, higher, lower, worthy, unworthy. In other words, polarization, which is a huge moment that we are in, because it has become so incredibly poignant for us. Nobody will nobody denies it whatsoever.
Right.
That just the way in which we completely point the finger at each other and going on.
So I feel like Maharaji is giving me an aloop right now to speak about this particular
subject.
Give me
a what?
An aloop. You know, your basketball terminology.
Oh,
alley.
Favorite
words.
Alley? Yeah. It's alley.
Alley. Okay. Alley. Alley, alley. Is that what we're going to call this? Alley-oop with Jamie Carpenter on the mind rolling?
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
So I have grown to love the darkness and the unknown, because I finally, sort of the math never added up about why I didn't like the unknown. It was only just because I didn't like change. Well, that's just another way of saying that I didn't, I wasn't mature. Yeah. I just, I was immature, and immaturity doesn't like change, because it's afraid of what if I don't have the thing that's needed when we get there? Like, what if I don't want to do that? Oh, I don't like change. It forces me to maybe not have something that is required, I think, is what keeps people out of change. And so that was what kept me out of it for a long time. And so the unknown was not a good thing. And then, of course, you know, you die on ayahuasca, you like do some sweat lodges or whatever, you practice in a tradition that honors death for a while, and things can change around that. But I just realized at a certain point that everything that I love came from the unknown. Everything. Nothing was known. It all came from the unknown. My mother, my father, this great earth, it all came from a place that we don't know. And it's going back to wherever, a place that we don't know. And maybe the place that we don't know is here right now. You know, it's actually here and caring for us, and has been all along. Just giving us the opportunity to live in it, you know, just to be alive. So the unknown is just like, it's where everything comes from. It's like our true nationality, you know, and that's what I've started calling it Mother Unknown, because of the difficulty around the unknown. I'm like calling it the mother, just like you, you before the retreat, I called you up and I was having a situation and you gave me this teaching. You jumped into this teaching about mother, what it means, what mother means. And it was so beautiful, and it cut through, and it's exactly right. It's just, it's unconditional caring. Just, that's what you said, basically, is like, it's just unconditional. It is its great pleasure to take care of us. And so I'm really happy to be alive now, just to have a shot, you know, like it's good enough to be alive. And so the unknown, like, who cares? Who cares? It's actually, I care a lot. And I love the unknown, because who knows what's coming around the corner? And would we shun it when it came and it brought benefit? We'd love the unknown then. It's what happens mostly.
Yeah.
Even through the difficult moments.
Yeah. I was in Maui on my way to see Ram Dass one day, and it was Duncan Trussell, my good friend, podcaster.
Heard of him.
Yeah. He.
I'm coming for you, man. I really want to be your friend, Duncan.
He was there. He was going to attend the retreat that was going to happen the following week. And I said, well, why don't you come with me so you can meet him? He had met him on, Ram Dass used to do, not Zoom, whatever the other thing. What was the other thing?
Skype.
Skype, yeah.
Skype?
Yeah, yeah. So he came along. It was just after, literally just after weeks, I think, his mother had passed. That was a huge happening for him. That he, that's in, you know, that wonderful Netflix show, Midnight Gospel. That last episode, features his mom. It's really incredible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anyhow, we came along and we were going to have dinner. We went to have, there was a number of people with Ram Dass, and one person in particular who was there was Roshi Joan Halifax. I think you know who she is, right?
Love Roshi Joan. I've only met her once, but yeah, I love her. Her contribution she's a really quiet hero of so much within psychedelics and compassionate care, insane contributions.
Yeah.
Yeah, big fan.
So he had the time of his life, me physically meeting Ram Dass and all that, and swimming in the pool, and you know, how Ram Dass is, whatever, with everyone. It's just complete absorption into it's, we're here together. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just simplicity. Yeah. So anyhow, then we're just sitting and having dinner, and he was speaking about his experience with his mother and her death, and asking for advice from them in terms of what death really means and how he still feels her, but he doesn't know. And Ram Dass, he doesn't know how to absorb that on a day-to-day basis. And Ram Dass started talking to him and brought out in the moment that here she is, completely available, Duncan, you know. And quite a moment. And then Roshi started talking about the thing that we all need to do is make friends with the mystery. It's not an enemy. The mystery includes the possibilities, all possibilities. It's not a nihilistic view of a zero that happens. The mystery may come from the zero, but is not a zero, if that's a way to say that. She used to bring it up at different points when she would teach or I would do podcasts with her. And I love it. I have always loved it because embracing that mystery. And, you know, it's easy to say all these things that we're saying are easy to say. And I did mention, Jamie, what you went through in your earlier days was, as you said, certainly great foundation to be able to speak to someone honestly without saying things which emanate from where one is not, at least yet.
Yes.
It's easy. Yeah. We all do it and it's okay. And I don't think there's a podcast that goes by where I don't quote Jack Kornfield. We're human. It's okay.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. And we're so much more than human even. That's the thing. Like even that statement, it was such a great statement. And we're so much more than even that, you know, we're kind of nothing also and everything. And it's a very unique situation to be in, to be nothing and everything.
Yeah.
So
but
it
that
feels like,
yeah, I get you, but you're doing exactly what I just mentioned that we shouldn't do. And the fact is, meaning we're human, that we don't have to judge ourselves. That's the point.
Yeah.
That's the real point.
Sure.
The fact that we are also beyond the two, we don't know that. It's way out there. And it's good to bring it into a meditative practice. You know, I mean, the highest being, what Roshi represents in the Zen tradition. But yeah.
But this is what Shogam Trungpa and Ram Dass did at Naropa in 1974, exactly what we're doing right now. And actually, this is the month that it was going on there.
Really?
I feel like, yes. And it's
I
the
was
50
there
year
with him
anniversary.
In that moment. Jesus. God.
I mean, because you're talking about the one and I'm talking about the zero, which I didn't know there was a zero. I thought it was all one. And then I've been studying, you know, Trungpa and there's just, he talks about the zero. It all, even the one emanates from zero, from the nothing place.
Emptiness.
It's like that. Yeah. And the one feels a little, I have to say, the more I've studied, it feels like a little too comfortable still. I kind of crave, I'm one of these people who just craves like, practice, and I'm not satisfied. I'm not also struggling in non-satisfaction of I'm not trying to arrive somewhere, but every time I learn something, it's like some old truth goes away, which also might affect what kind of show I'm watching, what kind of friendships I want to have, you know, what I eat. Like whenever something, I move into the unknown and I go into zero, it affects some part of my life in a way. And it can end up feeling really, I don't know, oddly high quality boring, because you just can't be entertained anymore as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember going over and watching basketball with you for the first time. And I was like, I didn't know Raghu watches basketball. And I grew up loving it. So any excuse to watch it is great. But then I also didn't know that Bhakti's or pick winners or
Bhakti's
get upset
pick
when
winners. If you're not winning, I turn the channel. We'll find another team. Forget about it. Oh God.
But it was just, I was learning that there's still, you're talking about the human thing. And I think you have preferences that the Golden State Warriors win a game rather than lose. And it was so funny that first time hanging out, because I was really paying attention. I'm at Raghu's house. Like even peeing at your house was like the first time I was there. And now,
crazy.
It was a big deal, but now it's normal. It's normal. And it's kind of like very normal driving over to your house. And I come over unannounced sometimes because you told me I can. And it's just so damn normal. I kind of miss the mystery a little bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a concept. All right. I want to bring something up because we're talking to referring to the mystery. And this is interesting. She talks about it in relationship. And I know you, Jamie has a really healthy, positive relationship. Because I've known these guys over the last several years, I guess. And
yeah, thank you for saying that. Lacey.
Yeah, Lacey. Love Lacey. Mm-hmm. So what she did with her partner, the suggestion was that they made a vow to remember to meet one another as the mystery. Think about what that means. Meeting one another with the same quality of presence with which we would meet the mystery itself, and that includes awe. That includes awe. For us, this has meant being committed to perceiving one another with openness, curiosity, and beginner's mind.
Yeah,
I thought, wow, what a great suggestion, because there is so much pain in our world, more and more and more, in many different ways. And one of them is in relationship, so taking on that suggestion, I think, is absolutely a wonderful, wonderful practice. I loved it.
Absolutely. One of the things Lacey and I have done more recently is, we've been together 8 years. We owned a mental health and addictions treatment center together. Which we've never owned a business before. I was a former homeless drug addict, and traumatized person. I've never owned really anything. And a few years ago, we opened up a treatment center, and that's a big deal, And we worked in that environment. We lived together. We carpooled together. We podcasted together. We do everything really together. It's based in what you're saying. It's based 100% in honoring the mystery. Like her and I got together and we started, our early dates were meeting at sunset to read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying to each other.
Oh, really?
While looking at the sunset. Yeah. Acknowledging the end, that the end comes, at the beginning. So we started there and just like, hey, we can't hold on to this. So what's beginning here? Let's acknowledge that it's going to be like that sunset. And we've kind of walked our own spiritual path and taken care of ourselves. And we've done that in a succession of amount of years to where now we don't have to really prove our love to each other. And it's weird that in relationship, there's all these still these measures where people are still needing, even after years of being together, like the way I say I love you or the way you do something. It's like at a certain point, it feels like if love isn't proven, if staying power isn't proven, especially after a number of years, what, we're still in this negotiation barter thing? Mm. Like what Neem Karoli Baba has taught is unconditional love exists on the earth. And why are we doing anything else? Or why are we striving for anything else? And so her and I have kind of, as a practice, strived to kind of like how everybody wants to do it a little better than their parents, or you want to do it better than the last job you had or whatever. Like we've wanted to do this in this relationship in order to preserve it. Maintain your own lanes, take care of your own spiritual practice, and don't hold each other to any person that you've been before. And also that can be done in a monogamous space.
That's no problem.
It can, but you know, the miracle also, and I want to talk to you about this because this is what bothers me, is that in my own spiritual development, it's been harder and harder for me to see how sex has gotten so caught up in spiritual teacherness. I mean, I get it. I get how it happens, ego and this and that. And even some situations, maybe you can't judge because you don't know what's going on. No one should, but in any case, where there's been so much, like where people use their spiritual power in order to gain, to have sex with people. And the further I've gone in my understanding of how everything is connected, you kind of see where harm is everywhere, you know, and how easy it is to harm somebody. And I can't even get my head around how these abuses sexually in power, like have gone on so long, because it's not my experience. My experience is actually monogamy, while actually I work intimately with tons of people, you know, so many people over the last 10 years, like thousands of people, and intimately. And it takes a skill, but it really just takes the acknowledgement that harm is so easy to do. And how can you read, how can you ever read where someone is at, even if they say they're okay, you know, and how spiritual teachers have taken advantage of this? It boggles my mind. And I want to say that there's another way, because I'm in a monogamous relationship and we're obsessed with each other, and we've been together every day for 8 years and working in the toughest fields, and still I'm not looking for anything outside of that.
Yeah.
Even with all this attention that I get, you know?
Yeah. This has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. Even in the scriptures of Eastern scriptures, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever, Buddha himself was beguiled by that. He just happened to be beyond it, and he was able to not react in the moment that that happened. And it's hard to be a Buddha in the city. And we are in that moment, you know, where look at all these Tibetans, you know, all the troubles you hear about of exactly what you're speaking to. It's
the author of the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying.
Including. Them, but it's not a reason not to use that book. That's my opinion.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, this is power. Look, the dynamic of, we were speaking to it a little bit of polarity when we don't accept the dark and the polarity that gets created within us and with you know, beyond to other people, that that polarity creates all the desire systems to fulfill what we think we're missing. It's the realm of the hungry ghost.
Yeah.
Gabor Mate, you know, Gabor is, wrote a great book, Realm of the Hungry Ghost, something.
It's an amazing book. Amazing concept.
Yeah.
Buddhist concept. It's like a non-acknowledgement. It's just some area that somebody's not looking at. That's it. It really comes down to that. It's some area where you think you can get by and cheat something. But I just found that like there's nowhere to go away in my mind. Like I see everything that I do. I hear all my thoughts. I see what my actions are. And not everyone's paying attention to that or actually in a good relationship with that. But I hear mine and it's a trustworthy place. You know, but there's no way. If I cheat, I hear it here. And I'm always looking over my shoulder to get caught. And even if the best people who are able to hurt people and move beyond, there's still a bit of that thing that Ram Dass talked about of like psychic energy that follows you for years afterwards after doing paranoid behavior. And I don't want to live with that.
Yeah.
There is no way.
You said it all. You want to really harm people, you know, right. Even if they're willing to engage in the harm for whatever reason. I mean, there's so many different motivations from the person who's committing the act to the person who's receiving it. There's such a huge mashup of trauma, you know, that we feed each other with it and so on. In this particular case, it's massive trauma, sexual abuse. So
on both sides,
yeah,
on both sides. And that's the thing. You look enough and there's no one to find to blame. There's a joke that I came up with in my head about like, maybe it's like, you know, maybe we could trace it all back to one guy. And it was like, Mike fucked everything up for everybody. He hurt one person started this whole thing. But really, we can't blame anybody even, you know, and we're all at the moment, you know, coming out of being victims, or we're maybe even acknowledging that we have been a victim of this and that. And I want to just say, don't get hung up there for long. It's a vehicle, you know, being a victim is a vehicle to change, and don't get caught up in a diagnosis. You know, I watch diagnoses be smashed through deep emotional work and attunement from someone else being there and a witness, you know, so. And that's what Lacey and I do. I guess I rarely like plug or take a plug space, but I will say that my partner and I do this work.
And I've seen you and I totally concur. Now you were just, we want to finish up here with something. You were referring to mindfulness practice, really being aware of motivations, of the story that you tell yourself and so on, which is key to being able to get to the place that I encourage us all to get to, which is a place of balance, acknowledging our humanness and we screw up all the time. At the same time, not wanting to harm anybody. You know, what is His Holiness calls it, just the moral issues on a human level, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily in spiritual ones. So mindfulness is practice. It's a way of waking up from our collective amnesia.
Wow. Perfect.
Isn't that a great word? When we return our attention to present moment, compassionate awareness, we remember who we are beyond skewed perception. We remember our original consciousness or innate connection to source. We awaken to the backdrop of interconnection that exists in every moment of our life. This interconnection never leaves it, although we may regularly leave it. And, you know, Maharaji used to say to us all the time, I will never leave you. You may leave me. I will never leave you. You know, so it's hard. Either we're thinking of ourselves with such grandeur of who we are or aren't, same thing. Or we're just absolutely floundering around in terms of dealing with our trust, our faith in that place that's beyond, that is the mystery, you know. So I want to say, before we go.
By the way, but just to add to that.
Yes.
I was just saying to Lacey this morning, about something that you said about a while ago, that Maharaji said, I've taken care of everything and left you the mind. Like that's
awful.
Like can't you just hold that? Can't you just take care of that? Basically just take care of the mind. Everything else is on rails. I keep calling it on rails. Yeah. Like it's just, we're locked in. And that has become more and more apparent to me. And I just said to her today, like, I completely believe now that my life is on rails and that really all I have to do is work with my mind. Yeah. Because the more that I've worked with that and just let go of agenda and all that, really my whole life story, I'm getting to interview on my podcast now. Like my whole life story, I mean, like people who were my heroes, people I've looked up to along the way, are now coming to have conversation with me. And I have nothing to offer them other than the conversation. Right. I can't offer big numbers like they have in their life and everything, but I've been able to offer these kinds of conversations. And I believe that in truly practicing compassion and unconditional love in as much as you can muster, your life being on rails and the specifics of the things that you're interested in also will show up, you know? At least that's been my experience and other people's experience that I worked with.
Yeah.
So anyway, what were you going to say?
Nothing. Go with the flow. No flow, you go. And actually, Ram Dass had a mantra in India at one point. Faith, no fear. Faith, no fear. That's a good one, right? Oh, boy. Thanks, Jamie, for being here. I want to remind everybody also about this wonderful audio book. This is my little commercial, Jamie. Sure. From the movie of me to the movie of we that Duncan Trussell and I have as an audiobook that's out there in all the regular Audible platform, Amazon, Apple. And it got a lot of references to some of what we have been addressing in this podcast. So go ahead and go to movieofme.com and you'll see samples, et cetera, and links and all of it. And I thank you for whatever engagement you can give to it. And this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com for a plethora of extraordinary presenters, teachers, podcasters. Again, thanks, Jamie.
Thanks so much, Raghu. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.